Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the legacy meeting to order today, and I'm pretty impressed to see everybody's made it to St. Paul and with the weather and all that going on. We're going to mix up the agenda just for a second, and we're going to bring up the Riverwatch folks first, if that's okay, and then we'll proceed down the agenda after that. But please come forward and
all right.
Hi, good morning, or afternoon, rather. Thank you for coming, and please go ahead when you're ready.
My name is Andy Alvin. I live in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, and I work with the International Water Institute. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it is my pleasure to be here with you all today on behalf of the Red River Basin Riverwatch Program. Our program has grown from a pilot project with a few schools in the Sandhill River watershed to its current state with over 20 schools on the Minnesota side of the Red River. From the Bois de Soux River in the south to the Two and Roseau Rivers in the north, students participate in water quality and biological monitoring, guided river explorers kayak trips, the annual Riverwatch Forum, and deploy real-time monitoring stations. This past year, our Riverwatch program reached over 250 students in Minnesota, 58% of whom were female and 11% of whom were non-majority ethnicity. Additionally, 600 students from third through fifth grades participated in our River of Dreams program, which builds a base understanding of the watershed concept and instills a sense of place among rural Minnesota youth. Students emerge from our programs with a greater understanding of how their local watershed functions and the importance of studying and protecting our water resources. As a former Riverwatch student myself from Hawley, Minnesota, I would not be here today if not for this program. And with that, I'm pleased to introduce Mr. Roy Maeda from Campbell Tinta High School to tell you a little bit more about how the program functions at the school level.
Thank you very much, Mr. Maeda. Please go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Roy Maeda, science teacher and Riverwatch advisor from Campbell Tinta High School. And I've been involved with the Riverwatch program since the 04-05 school year, initially with Wheaton High School and for the last quite a few years with Campbell Tinta. The Riverwatch program affords my students an opportunity really that they would not have in a smaller school such as Campbell. They're exposed to direct experience in field science, but it goes a lot beyond that. They gain a lot of experience working in teams on projects to present to their fellow Riverwatch students at the annual forum. They gain experience in public speaking. Here you'll speak with a couple of my younger students. At the forum, they've presented to the watershed district, the school board. They also present to elementary classes periodically at our school, explaining about snow sampling, river sampling, the River of Dreams program, which you'll also hear more about later. They gain experience dealing with and understanding connectivity, both environmentally and socially, dealing with people with different interests in business and agriculture as well as in science, and just a firsthand look now at the political interaction. We've had a number of students go on to college, and finally in 2014 did have the pleasure of having a graduate actually enter natural resources studies, and he's actually graduated since and has worked with the International Water Institute as well as other agencies. Is doing very well, and a lot of that is directly due to his involvement through Riverwatch. So if I could, I guess we'll let Mr. Alvin introduce
Mr. Alvin, we're also joined by Representative Fabian. I don't know if he's able to come up, and I know Representative Fabian has a bill related to this that's in it's on Environment Committee kind of path, and then but I know he's been a leader on this and for that area of Minnesota, but it's a neat program you're working on. Representative Fabian, can you go ahead when you're however you want to proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and lend my support to the River Watch program. It's nice to be able to hear somebody talk about Campbell Pinta, Wheaton, and Herman and that area. I've spent a lot of time there. The River Watch program is something that I really do support. I enjoy what I like about it is we've actually had it in the Roseau School District. It affords an outdoor opportunity for students to get outside and get out of the classroom, bring things back to the classroom and take a look at the invertebrates and so forth that they find, and monitoring water quality and so forth. So, Mr. Chair, I think, honestly, the testimony of the students and so forth is way more important than mine, and I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to come down here and lend my support to this program and the appropriation that we're asking for. And with that, Mr. Chair, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'm going to let the smart people take over.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. I know you've been a leader in this and fighting hard for your area of the state of Minnesota, and we all appreciate that. So please stick around, and we'll maybe there'll be some tough questions from Representative Green. But
later. It'll be in my office. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Oven, if you want to proceed. Yeah, sorry for the interruption.
No problem. We'll call Ms. Carrie Rath forward and tell you a little bit more about the River of Dreams program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carrie Rath, and I teach third grade in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. And I love this program, the River of Dreams program, because it's hands-on learning, and that's something that children really get a lot out of. It's there's three different components to it. There's a reading component and a watching and a listening component, in which I bring in presenters like Mr. Alvin here, and he can answer questions that, because he's an expert in his field of study, that I can't necessarily answer as a teacher. And so, and then there's the doing aspect of this program, where students actually get a 14-inch canoe, and they get to design it, they get to decorate it, and then the best part is they get to launch it in the river, and they get to track it on its way with the hopes of one day it getting to the ocean. The River of Dreams program is also cross-curricular, which means as an elementary teacher, I teach every subject area. And so with the River of Dreams program, I'm able to pull in every subject area. I bring in science and STEM. I bring in social studies. I bring in language arts with creative thinking and with creative writing. And the art component of it, where they get to design and decorate their canoe. And then the physical education aspect of it. Last year, I was fortunate enough to have my 9-year-old son in my class. And after we launched our canoes, he's like, "Hey, Mom, can we go kayaking? Let's go look for canoes." And so we got in the canoe in our kayaks, and we went in Plummer, Minnesota, and we found 33 of these little canoes, and we put them all in our kayak, and then we set them free. And then a week later, we launched our canoes. And then he's like, "Hey, let's go down the Clearwater River and the Red Lake River and the Thief River and see if we can find these canoes." And so we did that all summer long, and I think that gets kids up, it gets them active, and it sparks an interest in them. And if they're up and they're active, they're not on their devices all summer long. I had a couple other students whose parents came up to me and said, "Let's go looking for canoes. Let's get in the river. Let's get in our kayaks. Let's go looking for canoes." And so so it gets kids up, it gets them active, and it sparks an interest that hopefully will carry on into the Riverwatch program in high school, and then hopefully it'll spark an interest and it'll expose them to careers in the science field. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And now we'll have two students from the Campbell Tinta Riverwatch team come forward and tell you about their experience.
Welcome. Thank you for coming down, and go ahead and state your names and proceed when you're ready.
My name is Sophie Vieger. I'm a freshman at Campbell Tinta, and I've been in Riverwatch for 3 years.
Thank you, Sophie.
I'm Mary Rupp. I'm from Campbell Tinta. I'm a freshman, and I've been in Riverwatch for 3 years.
So Riverwatch is a group where every month we sample at various sites for DO, pH, and turbidity and conductivity. DO is dissolved oxygen in the water, pH is acidity in the water, and turbidity is the clarity. and conductivity is dissolved solids. Every year we start the year with a kickoff, and at the kickoff they give us a problem or task that your Riverwatch group needs to solve or think about, and then we have a forum which awards the best video or presentation with that. And then things we've learned, we learn a lot with Riverwatch, and one thing we learn is team building. Our team building has taught us to work with others that have different opinions and ideas to accomplish tasks. Another thing we learn is by doing, getting the hands-on learning activities that can help us in the real world. Riverwatch has given us a new aspect for the river, letting us learning what affects the river and how to minimize the damage humans cause with the river.
We joined Riverwatch for the future opportunities and career paths that are now offered to us that we joined Riverwatch, and it also taught us valuable life lessons that can help us succeed. And we also got to do things that we never thought we would be doing, like kayaking and macroinvertebrate sampling. And we also did it to join our, help our local waterways to clean them up because they're not the cleanest.
Is that it, Ms. Rupp?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And Ms. Bigger, thank you very much for coming. So I don't know if you want to come forward, Mr. Uven, and just kind of, there may be some questions for the students as well later. So.
For sure. Yeah, I think at this time we can open it up to questions if there are any. For any individual members or myself, we'll try to do the best we can to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Any questions from members or anything? I don't. Representative Wagenius.
Tell me about the biology that you check on.
Sure.
What is it? Do you catch fish, shrimps? What do you do?
And both Mary and Sophie have been out with me to sample the South Fork Rabbit River. But basically, we try to follow the protocols that are established by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to do a biological assessment of the stream health. And while our assessment is not an official assessment, it's meant to replicate that so that students see the process of using the D-net kick frame nets to kick around in the river to sort through and pick bugs, look at the blood worms and mayflies and different indicators of water quality. So we're really getting our hands into the mud and sorting through the bugs, and then based on different scoring sheets, learning about the health of the river. So it's more of an educational exposure to that process.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. I was just wondering to hear maybe from the students what they found the most interesting. I mean, you mentioned some of the things, but did you find any discoveries that you surprised you or you told your family about later or that sort of thing? Either one of you can just kind of.
I guess I Ms. joined Riverwatch and I never really knew what any of like turbidity or conductivity was. So that was kind of interesting to find out once I joined.
Ms. Baker?
We have also found out many things about the river that we'd never known. It's very interesting to learn and to try to help make our river a better water system.
And these two got to paddle down the Rabbit River with me to the confluence with the Bois de Soux River. So they got to kind of stand at the confluence point. And, well, for me, that's always exciting.
Mr. Uven, so then a lot of the work is done from the shoreline or from in the boats? Or how is most is done?
Mr. Chair, the majority of our work when we're out water quality sampling is done from bridges or up on top of culverts. But then we have these additional programs that enhance and go beyond the just looking at a sond reading or taking a turbidity tube or secchi tube reading. So we actually will lead kayak trips, and we try to get to each school every other year with a paddle trip of their local river. and then also to do a macroinvertebrate sampling to get another perspective of water quality.
Well, thank you very much for coming down today. I imagine it took some great effort. So we really appreciate that, and thank you for telling the stories. I think as members, we're often, I think, some of the best lobbyists around this building are kids, in my mind, and seeing in their eyes and hearing their stories of what they're about. Much of what's going on today, I was just driving in, and WCCO Radio and Public Radio, both of them had stuff with some of the impacts to our nature that's going on. So we really need our youth excited. And, you know, they talked about the problems with monarchs and bumblebees. And we actually have some scary stuff out there right now, and with the emerald ash borer and the chronic wasting. I mean, I don't want to scare you all, but it's you know, we all need to be in the game and paying attention to these things, and be thoughtful about our water quality and other issues, because Minnesota is a great state, but we now got to fight for it to keep it better. Thank you very much for coming down today, and enjoyed your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, and Mr. Fabian for giving us the opportunity to come down.
Thank you. So I'm sorry we're continuing to mix up the agenda so a little bit here. We know the students had to get on the move, so we wanted to respect that. And we have folks here from, I think it's Duluth Days, and so if Representative Olson would like to come forward, we actually have a... So we actually have a bill, and I'd like to move that House File 1324 to have it before us, and I'm moving it for possible inclusion into the legacy omnibus bill, if you will.
All right.
But Representative Olson, thank you very much for coming, and I appreciate that. Hopefully we all can get Representative Murphy and yourself are making sure that we get down to Duluth and that we care. I saw some amazing pictures today on Twitter about the moon last night. It would have been a neat time to be in Duluth over the lake. But Representative Olson.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And I do invite you to the Duluth Days at the Intercontinental Hotel, being Chair Lilly brought it up, from 4:30 until 8 tonight. And I believe the Great Lakes Aquarium folks actually will have an exhibit there or have a booth there, so you're welcome to learn more if you're able to make it down. But thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for being here for House File 1324. It is asking for a $250,000 appropriation to the Lake Superior Center Authority, or the Great Lakes Aquarium, to prepare and construct an exhibit demonstrating the role of water in Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. And with that, we have two testifiers who braved the roads in the storm to be here today, so I will turn it over to them.
Okay. Please state your name and go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you. My name is Jay Walker. I'm the Interim Executive Director at the Great Lakes Aquarium. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, representatives.
Thank you, Mr. Rock.
Thank you, Ms. Olson, for supporting this bill, and thank you, Mary Murphy, for your ongoing support as well. I am here today with our Director of Education, Sarah Erickson, and who is our Director, I should say, Education of Learning Engagement. Apologize. Quick side note, you also hear us talking as the Great Lakes Aquarium, but our legal name is Lake Superior Center Doing Business as Great Lakes Aquarium, and Lake Superior Center Authority is the state entity put in place to oversee the state's investments in our building and our grounds. A little bit about ourselves. The Great Lakes Aquarium is a nonprofit organization based in Duluth, Minnesota, that was charged by the legislature with delivering freshwater education for community. Today, 19 years after the aquarium opened on Duluth's waterfront, we are still focused on connecting people to Lake Superior and the waters of the world through hands-on exhibits, animal encounters, educational and interpretive programming. I personally have been with the organization since 1999, and I can say that this is one of the most exciting eras in the past two decades. Attendance has been on the rise consistently for the past 10 years. In 2018, more than 176,000 people participated in aquarium programs, exhibit exploration, and freshwater learning. Our educational programming has grown to include opportunities for youth and adults of all ages. With preschool classes, camps, field trip options, volunteering, internships, and public engagement. We are actively involved in collaborating with partners throughout the state on freshwater and Great Lakes education. A couple of these partners, most recently we developed an exhibit about Lake Superior climate change for the Eco Experience building at the Minnesota State Fair. This engaged with 250,000 people during the run of the fair. In March, we will be welcoming the We Are Water exhibit for a six-week stay on its statewide tour in partnership with the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, Minnesota Humanities Center, and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We have a strong history in bringing science, play, wildlife, and water exploration to the public. Several of our largest projects have benefited from legacy arts and cultural heritage funding. In 2013 and 2014, the award-winning original exhibit Shipwrecks Alive was made possible with $200,000 in legacy funds and more than $150,000 in matching and in-kind support from partners and the aquarium operational budget. More than 500,000 people have engaged with this gallery showcasing Minnesota's underwater, rich underwater history. In 2015 and 2016, the legislature allocated $250,000 in arts and cultural heritage funding that, along with more than $470,000 in matching and in-kind support from individuals, the City of Duluth, and the aquarium's operational budget, made Unsalted Seas a reality. This exhibit focused on large lakes around the world and featured, probably one of my favorite displays and many others, a 9,000-gallon sturgeon touch pool, and this has become a staple for Duluth visitors. Legacy funding enables us to leverage significant resources from partners. It allows us to tell big and important stories in accessible and meaningful ways. It allows us to draw people into the world of freshwater, a vital topic here in Minnesota, such a rich water state. We are grateful for your past support and for your consideration in 2019. And the project we're here to talk to you about today invites people to splash and learn with each other about the wonders of water. It is an exhibit we are calling H2O. And I would like to turn this over to my partner, Sarah Erickson, to tell you about the project.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. We're a little disappointed you didn't bring a surgeon for us today.
they do not like the snow, so we have to keep them home.
Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Chair members. You'll have to just come visit us to touch the sturgeon. We'd love to have you on a field trip at some point. My name is Sarah Erickson. I'm the Director of Learning and Engagement at the Aquarium, and we're excited to showcase water in a new way in our space. And as you all know, water connects us with each other and with the world. And when people understand the role of water in their lives, they're better equipped to address major issues such as climate change, fisheries management, weather and water safety, drinking water safety, and this is vital for the water-rich future of Minnesota. Our organization exists to showcase the freshwater ecosystems, and we do that through engagement and play and hands-on learning. And in 2020, it'll be our 20th anniversary as a facility open on the Duluth waterfront. And we're excited to celebrate that 20th anniversary with a vibrant new exhibit called H2O. We have a packet in your folder today. And in the center fold of that packet, pages 3 and 4, gives you sort of a picture view of what we're imagining. But I'll describe it with words, what we're hoping to do. Even though we, as humans, interact with water on a daily basis, it's not often that we pause to explore how water works. What's special about it? Why does it do the things it does? How would our lives be different without water? What if all the water was, say, something like Play-Doh? How do we know if the water is safe to drink? How do we keep it clean? What are people doing in our area to celebrate, improve, and protect water? And how does it connect us to the world? So we're working it toward a new exhibit gallery that explores these questions through hands-on interactive exhibits. It will feature elements that engage people with simply the properties of water, methods for maintaining healthy ecosystems, and the role that the Great Lakes in particular plays in human communities. Woven into these tactile experiences will be opportunities to explore the ecology, the cultural history, and the economic importance of Lake Superior and the Great Lakes. So this is a 2,500 square foot gallery. The main feature will be the Great Lakes Water Table, which demonstrates Minnesota's connection to the world. This new table, we currently have a Great Lakes Water Table. in need of some advancements to meet modern needs. And so this new water table will be designed for use by all people with access points at varying heights, with audio descriptions of content and tactile experiences for people with low vision. It will feature place names in English, Ojibwe, Braille, and other languages and characters. And we also are going to extend to make sure that we, again, are focusing on key properties of water in connection with the water cycle. We'll be placing conversational social cues to promote intergenerational learning and conversation. We want to provide opportunities to observe cause and effect and promote experimentation. And we want this exhibit to encourage creativity and collaboration to solve challenges. And these are all skills that are key to the health and vibrancy of successful Minnesota communities into the future. So we're going to be building on existing relationships with the state and county and city and tribal entities. We want to represent many touch points with the region's aquatic ecosystems. We, as part of this collaboration, we're looking to build an interactive model of the wastewater treatment facility that was vital to the improvement of the St. Louis River estuary and to the health of our area. We're all going to compare that to how we keep animals healthy in a life support system in kind of our own mini wastewater treatment plants, and then extend that to how that functions in a natural environment, looking at wetland function. So we're basically mimicking wetland function in these human-made systems. So this project, H2O, really encourages people to connect, play, and reflect surrounded by water and their community, and we really hope that you'll join us in this new adventure. This project, we're slated to open in the summer of 2020, again for the 20th anniversary of Great Lakes Aquarium, and our project budget is $410,000, and there's details about that in your brochure. And we're, again, requesting a $250,000 appropriation from Arts and Cultural Heritage funding. We hope that you will consider the great investments we've made in the past and what we've been able to leverage in making community connections and making these projects really successful and an essential part of our community. So thank you so much for your time and consideration, Chair and members, and we're happy to answer questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson and Mr. Walker. Any questions for the folks here today? Representative Murphy, do you have any?
I do not.
No, nothing? Vice Chair Wozlak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just want to say I really appreciate, I'm a visual person, so I really appreciate the visual graphic in your little thing here to help us kind of envision what that would look like. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you. You're welcome.
So thank you, Representative Olson. Very much appreciate the work that these folks have done. They've really, one of the things I appreciate is that they really seem to bring in a lot of matching money and a lot of community investment. So the 200, you know, the three different projects or the two other ones that you've done, you've stepped up and really done a lot on your own as well to match that and to grow it. A couple years ago, we had an opportunity, I think, on the Legacy Committee to tour it, or maybe on Capital Investment. I think I've been on a couple tours, and I always say this story, but it's funny because you have one of the best conference rooms in the world. You have a view over the harbor, but these folks are brilliant because they know how legislators are. They always shut the curtains. So, you know, you couldn't really see the ships or anything going by because they know we wouldn't be able to concentrate. So I thought that was really brilliant on your part, and you know, so we could actually focus on what you're saying. You do have a wonderful story. And it is neat to get there and see the kids, and I love that you're touching the water and the interactive part of it. Any questions or anything? I don't see any. Again, thank you for coming. I hope everybody the committee members will consider going down to Duluth Days. There's a lot of exciting things going on. Any final comments, Representative Olson?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. So with that, where are we, boss?
Thank you.
So I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1324 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Legacy Omnibus Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. So. thank you very much for coming, and hopefully we can get down there. And thank you. So with that, we'll move. We're back to the beginning of the agenda. So the Minnesota State Arts Board, please come up. Has anybody had an opportunity to take a peek at the minutes? Representative Hausman, are you willing to move the minutes? Thank you. Representative Hausman has moved the minutes for the February 13th meeting. Any questions to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The minutes for the February 13th meeting are approved. Thank you very much. Ms. Gents, welcome to our committee, and I know you've been here many times before, and you've got a wonderful story to tell and of the first 10 years, and you know, tell us about that and where we're going in the future.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's always a pleasure to be here with this committee and to have a chance to talk a little bit about the work we are doing. The work is so big and so broad that we can just touch on a few of the things that we're doing, but we certainly will do our best to try to give you a sense of what has happened at the beginning of the Legacy Amendment. We will talk today about how we have been investing legacy dollars since 2010, the first year that the dollars were available. And I'm going to be very, very brief today. Mainly, I will give you a little bit of background and context about how our system works and how the dollars are allocated. And we have several people here today who will be sharing stories with you about how the dollars are being invested and the impact that they're having in the lives of the residents and the communities that they're serving. And we do have a copy of our slides, and we also have a second handout for you that will help you lead us through this presentation. So just at a glance, some of you already know us. We are a state agency. We exist in the executive branch of state government, and we have existed in various forms for more than 100 years. Our mission, our structure, and our responsibilities are outlined in Minnesota statutes in Chapter 129D. And you see on the slide our mission, which is very broad. And that's intentional, and that's really beneficial, because in the arts, one size does not fit all. One person might really value classical ballet. Another person might be really passionate about spoken word. One grandparent might like to take their grandchildren to see a musical theater production on a Saturday afternoon. Another grandparent might like to pass on the native beadwork that her grandmother or her great-grandmother taught to her. So in the arts, what we're trying to do is to find a balance to meet the needs and the interests that exist across the state of Minnesota. We are primarily a grant maker, and when this committee back in 2009 created some guidelines for itself, one of the things it said was to use existing systems to distribute dollars, and you have been using the Arts Board to do that. We really appreciate that. Providing financial assistance is the primary reason that we exist. We're a statewide system. The Arts Board's grants go from International Falls to Worthington and many places in between. We also are the fiscal agent for 11 regional arts councils, and their boundaries cover every single county of the state. So we have a way that state dollars can reach throughout the state in two ways, either through the Arts Board or through the regional arts councils. We want there to be as many opportunities as possible for people to access these dollars. And the third phrase on this slide is really, we think, our great strength, which is that we are citizen-driven. It's not I'm not the person deciding what we fund. It's not our staff. It's not our board. It's individuals that we recruit and the regional arts councils recruit to read all of the applications and decide. We think that that important citizen input helps us invest dollars in the way Minnesotans would like them to be invested. All of our board members are volunteers. Our board chair, Sean Douse, the mayor of Red Wing, is here today. And he has 10 colleagues on our board. The Regional Arts Council boards are volunteers as well. And we really think that that's a strong way for us to be making decisions. I've put on the slide and also in the handout that we gave you, in 2009 we created for ourselves some long-term goals. What did we want to see that would be different in the state of Minnesota as a result of legacy funds? And you have the list of outcomes that we are working to achieve here. I think the second and the third are the most important. especially as far as legacy funds are concerned, to bring the arts into community life in vibrant ways, and you'll hear about that a little bit later on today, and also to expand who is able to participate in the arts, whether it's ages, ethnicities, or abilities, to have more and more opportunities to be involved. I'll talk a little bit about appropriations. You see on this slide, the green boxes are the general fund dollars. The Arts Board has been very fortunate to be funded through the general fund for decades and decades. In this biennium, our funding from the general fund is about $15 million. And as you can see, the gold bar is the legacy funds, which for us has really opened up all sorts of opportunities. And I can never look at this slide without thinking of the 2009 session and then Chair Murphy saying, how are we ever going to spend all of this money? and I said to her, you would be surprised at the imagination and the creativity and the innovation that this resource is going to bring out in Minnesota. And it's true. Some of you know, maybe all of you know, that in state statute it stipulates that 47% of available Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund dollars be managed through the Arts Board and Regional Arts Council system. So that would be our request for the biennium, 47% based on the math and the forecast. Right now the governor's budget has us in at $66.6 million, so just under $67 million for the biennium, and that would be our request going forward. Legacy dollars have taken the arts out of the concert hall and the theater and brought them into the community in ways that we never could before. We are using funds at the Arts Board to supplement two existing programs for artists and arts organizations, but we also created seven brand new programs, and those are listed in your handout along with some of the numbers of participants and dollars that have been invested. Likewise, Regional Arts Council's created new grant programs with legacy dollars, and you have all of those statistics. And I know I tend to be the statistics person, and other people are the storytellers, so we're going to get to them in just a second. But the numbers are impressive, and the numbers of people who have been touched by these dollars really have made such an important difference. They're creating greater access. We're not just investing in K-12 age young people anymore, but lifelong learning in the arts. We're investing in activities that build communities, bring people together, and strengthen our social fabric. And we're investing in ways to preserve and pass on our cultural traditions. And I'm going to leave you with two last numbers that I think are really vital. The first 9 years of the Legacy Amendment, the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils together have made nearly 14,000 grants throughout the entire state of Minnesota. And those grants have served a combined audience of 104 million participants. So we don't create exhibitions, we don't produce theater, we don't make ballet or dance. We invest in the ideas that Minnesotans think will be important for their quality of life and for their communities. And I'm going to stop there and ask my colleague, Mark Turner, to pick up and talk about some of the work that the Regional Arts Councils are doing.
Thank you, Ms. Jens. Go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
I'm Mark Turner. I'm the executive director of the Five Wings Regional Arts Council, which is up in Staples, Minnesota. We cover the five counties of Cass, Crow Wing, Todd, Morrison, and Wadena. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Regional Arts Councils, we're really kind of the field offices for the arts and cultural development out in Minnesota, all over the place. We're local nonprofits. We're led by local boards representing their home area. Legislature back in the mid-70s had the foresight to initiate these local boards with the goal really to stimulate arts and cultural development within all of our communities, and I think it's working. My humble opinion, I've been with the Regional Arts Council for 28 years now. I've seen a lot of trends, and it really heartens me, especially with the impact of legacy dollars, of what actually is really coming to light now with communities and arts and cultural development within those. The concept is really a decentralized planning and funding mechanism. That mechanism is valid, efficient, and most importantly, it ensures that statewide resources are accessible to all residents across the state. It's local folks making decisions on program priorities and grant making for their own communities, and that just seems to make sense to me. Again, it's working well. As Sue mentioned, there's 11 councils that cover every county in the state, and there's actually a little map, I think, on the back of page 2 in your handout that kind of shows how the divisions, the boundaries are. All county-based, and really it throws back to the mid-70s, and those are economic development lines of the time, but they seem to still be working now with each region having a having their unique flavor. So with that, each council is charged with designing and offering programs and services specifically tailored to their region. And there's a process which ensures that happens, including local needs assessments, public planning, public hearings on the plan and budget, et cetera. If folks are interested in that whole laundry list of criteria or requisites that happen, you can talk with either Sue or myself at some point. And it's quite a lengthy process to make all that happen. So with all that said, it would take a while to go through all the varying program services that all the regional arts councils do. There is, as Sue mentioned also, there's a laundry list of the different programs. Each regional arts council has individualized its priorities for their particular region, so I would encourage you to take a look at that and visit all the websites, especially in your own district, to see what opportunities are available there. What I can offer is, I'm not going to go through each program, but what I can offer is kind of a blanket statement, is that with the onset of legacy dollars, the regional arts councils all really reinvented themselves. I mean, and a lot of money will do that, of course. But they're definitely stronger than ever before, and the impact is longstanding, and you can see by the numbers it's quite impressive. I think it's the infrastructure that was already in place by the Regional Arts Council since the 70s really talks to that. We were already in place. We were able to hit the ground running, and I think we've been effective doing that. So similar to the Arts Board, the RACs use legacy dollars to fund programs and services specifically for creating and improving access to the arts, arts learning opportunities, and preserving cultural heritage. The one thing that may set us apart is that we work primarily with the smallest of organizations, the smallest of communities, real grassroots, all volunteer organizations. So we're really the local agents in the field, so to speak, and it works well. So many of our programs and services might be more tailored to capacity building for those organizations, those volunteer-driven groups, and professional development for our local organizations and communities to do their work better. Another observation I offer is the impact of legacy dollars to date is that we're now working more and more with a much broader community, broader community groups to bring arts opportunities to residents. And examples of that would be cities, healthcare organizations, particularly mental health organizations. We've seen a lot more of that. Senior centers, nursing homes, civic groups, tourism, and the list goes on. So really, what 20 years ago we were working primarily just with the arts organization itself, that term of community has really broadened. And the arts are really becoming a fabric of everyone's lives, which is encouraging. What we're also seeing at the RAC level, and especially in greater Minnesota, is more arts activities are more than just arts activities. It's really community development with the arts as a focal point. And I think maybe an example would talk to that best. Actually, in Representative Green's district in Monaga, Sounds of Spirit Lake concerts. I don't know, Representative Green, maybe you're aware of that effort there. But it's really a free series of musical concerts in the park. It's on the shore of Spirit Lake. The series is six Fridays during the summer months. It's outdoors, and a live musical lineup ranges from folk, ethnic, classic to contemporary. There's really something for everyone. Even the high school band stays sharp in the summer by performing at each concert. So it sounds like just a nice concert in the park, but let me explain what goes a little deeper and what I talk about the true community development that's going on. When you scratch the surface, this is the community building that's going on just with this one project. The city mayor MCs he insists on MCing the event and welcomes the community and visitors. The newspaper sends a reporter and photographer free of charge to each event and covers it for front page for the next week. The VFW offers their parking lot and expands their evening menu. I say I've been told by the residents there that that's a big hit. The Methodist Church sells food to support their young outreach programs, the city sprays for mosquitoes, of course, and blocks off the streets and provides temporary power and a source of, and sanitation services. The local police provide traffic support. The Lions shuttle folks from the assisted living and elder care facility and sponsor special parking for those who choose not to leave their vehicle during the concert. The school provides the sound equipment and acts as a rain site, and also the Monaga Marine and Rental actually built the stage for them, donated all the materials, built it. They put it up for each concert, take it down, and store it during the winter. Public TV records and replays the concerts throughout the off-season. And that's a lot of the activity that goes in. There's some things I'm missing there. It's a real source of pride for Minnaga residents, if you ask those folks. The buzz around the cafe when I stop in there every once in a while during the summer, I'll talk about that. So it's a sense of pride and community development that's really going on with a $4,000 grant. And that actually leverages another $11,000 in support throughout the summer. And that's a big deal in a town the size of Minnaga of a little over 1,000 people. So that's just one good example. Another one, Representative Heintzman, you're probably aware of the Greater Lakes Area Performing Arts in Pequot. Similar type of stuff. I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But interesting tidbit with that is they're actually partnered with the school to offer a technical certification in theater and sound systems. So they're working with the high school to actually have hands-on learning and technical skills with those students there. Lakes Area Music Festival, again in Representative Heitzman's area, is really kind of written the all access pass to classical music for the whole Lakes area in that area. They really do a bang up job. So again, I'm going down a rabbit hole with talking about all the different type of activities and the community development that goes on, but let me assure you that it is happening and it's really good stuff out there. There's more than 100 million stories to tell. We have the stat up there of 100 million participants over the 10 years. And I'm not going to be able to tell them all, so I'm going to hand it over to some other people we've invited here to share some of their stories.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Maybe the one event that you mentioned, we might have to get Representative Green involved.
Absolutely.
Might want to emcee it next year. You can arm wrestle with the mayor, it sounds like.
I think it's more of a leg wrestling thing.
Oh, leg wrestling. Thank you, Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chair, we have invited two organizations that are recipients of legacy funds to talk about their programs. We had invited a third, but the forces of nature have conspired against us. So if this works, we have a very brief video to show you from the Karen Organization of Minnesota, and then we'll turn to Ms. Beisel and Ms. Woods, if that is...
Yes, please. All right. Please proceed. Do you want to tell us about the video first, or...
I will tell you about the video. So the Arts Board has been funding the Karen Organization of Minnesota, for those of you who may not be familiar with it. It's a social service organization that helps refugees from the Burma region get established in Minnesota, in some cases learn the language, in some cases learn job skills, in some cases helps them find a place to live and to navigate the system in a place that is very, very different from the place that they came from. We have been funding a traditional weaving circle that uses a space in St. Paul. And what you're going to see is just 90 seconds about this weaving circle that we've been finding.
The Karen people from Burma have a very old tradition of weaving textiles. And so now that there are more than 13,000 Karen refugees in Minnesota, they really wanted an opportunity to begin practicing that tradition again and to teach the skills and the cultural knowledge to the youth.
Back in the Burma, we weave for our clothes. We have no money to buy. To buy our own clothes, so we have to make it by ourselves. One of the weavers, first when they came, she don't talk and then she feel lost. She feel like she's like useless because of that she cannot speak English. So she don't feel that her life is useful in here. But when she come here, she see that, oh, we can still weave. We can go to like participate with, we do something like weave demonstration, that she felt like she is part of her community.
My grandparent told me that weaving is part of our tradition. If we lose it, we have lost our people.
Wonderful. So that's a brief example of one of the ways that we are helping to preserve and pass on an important cultural tradition. And I love that sentence at the end, if we lose our weaving tradition, we lose our people. So it talks about the important significance, not just as an art form, but as a way of building community. So we will turn next, Mr. Chair, to Ms. Beisel from Common Bond Communities and then to Ms. Woods.
Thank you, Ms. Beisel. Please state your name and go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you. I'm Angie Beisel. I'm with Common Bond Communities. We're an affordable housing and services provider. We are primarily in the Twin Cities metro area, but in greater Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa as well. We were able to start offering arts programming at some of our senior housing communities in November 2016 by partnering with teaching artists and then offering our programs on site so that residents didn't need to leave their homes. This really fulfills our mission of keeping residents in their own homes, but also a couple of our important program areas, which is health and wellness and community building and engagement. We began offering programming with just two housing communities in 2016, and then we added six more the next year, and this year we added three more, so we're in a total of 12 housing communities now with this new programming. We've been funded through a couple of programs with the State Arts Board and also the Metropolitan Regional Arts Council. We recently, in January, had an arts exhibit with a couple housing community residents at our central office in St. Paul, and a couple of the residents shared the impact. One said, "Before this drawing class started, I was down in the dumps and stayed in my apartment most of the time. Now, so much is happening at our building, and I feel excited and like I'm part of something." Another said, "I was immediately hooked on this arts class. It's like a light turned on. It's brought sunlight into my life. Sometimes you feel useless and lonely as an older person. But doing this art brings back self-confidence and also brings us closer as neighbors." So a few of the outcomes that we've seen in our short time, we're increasing social connections. Our property managers have also said it's reducing conflict at our sites because people who didn't connect before are now connecting with each other. And residents are getting intellectually engaged again. They're problem solving together and working as a community. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you very much. It's neat to hear the different things that you're working on. Go ahead and state your name when you're ready.
Hi, I'm Christina Woods. I am from the Duluth area. It's nice to see Representative Murphy. I'm the executive director of the Duluth Art Institute. Buju Gakina Awiya. Anamiki Kwe Indijinaka, Misabi Kong Indunjaba, and I just introduced myself in Ojibwe Moin, which is my cultural heritage. There are so many stories I could share. I've been with the Duluth Art Institute a year and a half, and leading the organization has been quite exciting, and we are so grateful to be recipients of State Arts Board funding and grateful that the Arts Board is part of the legacy funding program, because we are seeing the impact of visual arts in our community in profound ways. I had a whole thing in my head that I was going to talk about, but I do want to share a couple of stories that have come up and change the direction of my presentation, because in listening to Angela, I too want to reiterate that some of the impacts that we're seeing with the visual arts in particular are really saving lives. Right first when I started working, artists were coming to me and talking about the importance of funding them as artists. And that's one of the things we do within the Duluth Art Institute is provide artist services. Services like resume writing, artist statements, how to plan for an exhibition, how to create a body of work, and most importantly, how to develop economy for yourself as an artist and how to reach into businesses and become part of the artistic process that goes on with marketing and design and all the different areas. One of the artist's stories that, two of them actually, that really stand out for me is a gentleman who provided art for our member show. And when he showed it to me, the second sentence out of his mouth was, "This is the only way I can connect to people." And I asked him to tell me more. He said, "I'm not able to have conversations with people unless we're looking at my art." It also has helped him stay sober for 15 years. Another story we have is a young artist who lives with Down syndrome, sharing with me that this is how she feels normal. She has art exhibitions. She understands what an art exhibition is. She told her mom at 8 that she wanted to have one someday. And this is how she connects to the community in ways that makes her feel valuable. And we hear these stories, these types of stories, over and over again when we open up access for artists to actually exhibit, work on their practice through our education classes or other classes within the area. And then also to open access to our community to experience the visual art on the other side. We recently had some significant changes in our Duluth Police Department policy about arresting people, and this is the quote, while black. We had an incident occur, an artist created an arts exhibition around it, and with the cooperation of the chief of police, Mike Tuscan, he was involved in the exhibition. There have been significant changes to our policy through the work of visual art. So I had a completely different presentation. I wanted to share those three stories. I've also been asked to talk about a particular grant that we've recently been awarded. It's called the Arts Access Grant. And the program we are instituting with this grant involves working with 7th grade students in the Duluth area. 7th graders currently in the Duluth area have 0 minutes of visual art education. And we feel that they are missing out on this beautiful, amazing creative process that is part of the STEM programming, but it's science, technology, engineering, arts, engineering, and mathematics. The creative process with the arts is just as important as the process of inquiry in science. And we are offering programming through State Arts Board funding to 7th graders to collectively work together to solve a problem, which they haven't identified yet, in the Duluth area or within their community. We're working with youth from underrepresented communities who often face marginalization due to race or poverty or other challenges in their life. And they're going to use visual art as the vehicle to motivate and challenge the community to make change that they see is needed. So we're offering an opportunity for youth to really lift their voices within the context of what will make our community in Duluth thrive and giving them an opportunity to develop leadership skills. So thank you very much. I appreciate all of your attention and giving me the opportunity to really share some of these impactful stories about how visual art is really making a difference in our community. Thank you very much, Miigwech.
Thank you, Ms. Woods. Your comments are timely, especially the I can't say the word very well,
indigenous?
I'm really bad at that. I want to say native, but maybe I can't say that. I don't know. But so on Monday, we had all of us gathered today, you know, and had a presentation. And so it was quite a big day in the legislature. But anyways, thank you for coming down and telling your story. Representative Erdahl, you have some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to our Arts Board folks here. First, I want to commend you for much of the work that you've done. I think you are an important part of our legacy funding and that you do excellent work for the most part. But every now and then, it seems, maybe once every other year or something or other like that, some program that is funded through the Arts Board happens and is frankly embarrassing to some of our members. Is there any way to safeguard against that from happening, or is this just going to be part of the way it is?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, thank you for the question. I'm not sure there's an easy answer to that, because part of the freedom of expression, part of the way that people express themselves, some people might find really positive and would find themselves agreeing with, and other people might find themselves feeling very negative about it and disagreeing with that. And we have not censored the content of projects or programs, wanting communities or individuals or organizations to be able to use the funds in a way to express themselves. Ms. Woods just talked about having young people in the community identify a problem that they think is important to them and potentially working with an artist to do some problem solving about that. There may be people in the community who don't think that's a problem, who don't necessarily think that that's a problem that needs to be addressed. But because art is so personal and art is so individual to each person who both makes it and the person who experiences it, I think it's inevitable that people will feel differently about work that they see. And I don't know if I've answered your question, but I mean, I think that's it is the nature of art.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, your, I guess your response was kind of what I anticipated. I know it's a tough question, and it's hard to answer, but you just need to keep in mind that you are spending public money, and that I can't say that you should, that you can address the sensitivities of all the public, but do keep in mind that, you know, it is public money, and we should do the best we can to spend it in a way that does not create controversy.
I don't know that was. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Representative Heitzman.
Mr. Chair, I saved my question till the very end of the presentation, so I'm improving.
Well,
so back to a comment that came up at slide 5, and it's not necessarily relevant to that, except that that's when the comment was made. And I just would like a clarification from the director. It's not any kind of a gotcha question. I'm just trying to get, like I said, a clarification. But the comment was that we're not just investing in K-12 anymore. And I think that if we look across the state, we see, especially in my part of the state, declining opportunities inside the K-12 system. And we've talked, I think, already a little bit today about some of the things that are being funded through the Arts Board that affect our students in a pretty positive way. And I just would, more than anything, like I said, a clarification of what you mean by that.
Ms. Jentz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heitzman, thank you for the chance to clarify that, because I realized as I said it, I was going very quickly. Before the legacy amendment passed, many of our grantees and many of our programs could fund activities that would enhance what was happening in the schools. It might be an artist residency program. The Arts Board had a very small program where we could make grants to schools and they could bring in an artist to supplement what was happening in the curriculum. With Legacy, we are able to do much more community-based arts education. Some of the programs that you heard about today, bringing artists into a senior residence, is part of that lifelong learning in the arts. Circling back, though, to what I think is your question about the schools, is that we couldn't agree with you more, that we would like to see more arts education in the regular K-12 curriculum. And the state of Minnesota has arts education standards written into the law. We know that many schools are not meeting those requirements in the law, and we wish that they would. For us, the challenge has been the legacy funds are to supplement, not substitute for. And because schools are required to provide a certain number of courses, a certain number of disciplines as part of the regular K-12 curriculum, our understanding was that those school formula funds should be providing that basic curricular education, and that what we can do is over and above what schools are required in law to produce through their regular K-12 formula funds. But I'm not an expert on arts education policy. There may be some of you who are. So what we've always talked about is the need to try to enhance and add on beyond what schools are required to provide in the state curriculum.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate the answer, and I think that does help me better understand what you meant. Another comment that sort of jumped out at me a little bit was as Representative Erdahl was wondering if we could avoid some of these things that have caused constituent concern, where they come and they have a frustration with a particular project. And I think what I heard, and here again if I could get a clarification, was that we are not censoring those proposals as they come. And I'm assuming that in the context of not censoring, we are actually censoring, and I hopefully am right in assuming that there are some things that are going to be coming to you and you're going to have to make a judgment call. Is it appropriate in terms of racially and some other sensitivities that would be, I think, pretty inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So we are, in fact, censoring to some extent, I hope.
Ms. Jens, I think there really is a question there. Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, certainly. In the process, people are bringing social sensitivities. We would not fund pornography. We would not fund things that are not legal. And that's written into our programs, that funds cannot be used for an activity that is not legal. On a topic that is sensitive, one person might think it's really important to express one point of view, and another person might think it's really important to express just the opposite point of view. And so we don't take a side on political issues, I guess is the right way to say it. We don't say that you have to be on one side of the politics or on the other side of politics. And I'm not sure if that is getting at your point, but I'm...
Well, I...
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to say this as delicately as I can. But in some cases, there has been projects that are artful that also depict illegal activity. And that's, I'm assuming, something that would be considered going forward because there that's causes some folks some concern.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, I think I know what we're talking about. If you think about something like lynching, that's also an illegal activity, and there have been many, many art pieces about lynching to show how horrific it is and how important it is to not let us forget about something like that happening. And so a piece of art that depicts an activity that is not legal sometimes has an important social message. Again, we're not saying that we want artists to necessarily bring forward pieces that have an important social message, but we do understand that artists will express different points of view with funds that are provided to them and that they're representing their own particular individual point of view.
Representative Heitzman?
Okay. You couldn't say that when he was...
Okay. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was not going to go into the specific grants that have been awarded today. But in this particular case, I think everybody knows what they're talking about. And I'm not afraid to say it. It's about the video game that, in my opinion, encouraged the illegal act of blowing up a pipeline. And the reason I'm not is because... As a member of White Earth, I will tell you that we fight constantly trying to keep our kids on the straight and narrow. And it's a real issue for me. I mean, it just is. And so when I see things coming forward that are depicted as art that encourages more criminal behavior, it bothers me a lot. And I won't go any further there. We'll discussion for another day. Because we're going to be talking about some funding for you guys later and the bills coming forward. What I would like to deal with today is the legislative auditor's report. And I'm not going to be pounding on you, but I would like you, if you would, to answer some of the, they're not really allegations, but they're findings of the legislative auditor, if that's possible. And the one thing that has come up time and again is supplement versus supplant. And I know that I brought this up before, and I can't remember if I really got a right answer or not, but before the legacy amendment, the general fund dollars going to the Arts Board was about $10 million. Correct? And since legacy has been enacted, and the Arts Board has gotten their full share of legacy. Now that's dropped down to about 7.5 from the general fund. Now, how do you answer that question of the replacement of those general fund dollars with legacy?
Ms. Gents, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, thank you. I really appreciate that question. Mm-hmm. So in 2008, 2009, so the 2 years right before the legacy dollars became available, the Arts Board was receiving approximately $10 million per year. So you were right on the amount that it was per year. Since the legacy amendment has been passed, our general fund appropriation has decreased to $7.5 million per year. So it's about 26% less than it was before the legacy amendment was passed. The way we have managed that decrease, and we would prefer that those dollars had not been decreased. We would, you know, obviously, we would prefer that we had stayed at that $10 million and that the legacy dollars could be over and above what we had been receiving. But that wasn't our choice. That was the legislature's choice to give us a different amount in that appropriation. What we have been doing is trying to maintain a proportional amount of funding in the two programs that we are continuing to use general fund dollars in. And I believe the auditors addressed this a bit to say that, yes, the dollars are less than they had been, but that's because we have fewer dollars from the general fund. But roughly the same proportion of the dollars are going into those two programs, and then we're supplementing with the legacy funds in two programs. The other programs that we have, there are seven more that are only using legacy dollars because they were new programs that we created. So I hope I've addressed that what we're doing is keeping the same proportion of the dollars, knowing that there are fewer dollars from general fund to be allocated.
Representative Green, and I don't know if everybody received a copy. Just recently the auditor came out with a report on the Arts Board, and I'll make sure everybody gets a copy if everybody hasn't, and just kind of, but I know you've been great at looking at them. I had an opportunity to sit down and visit with them, but Representative Green, please keep going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just go down the list here. The first one that I'm going to touch on would be, and I'll just read it because it's easier than me trying to pose my own question. During the meetings, the board makes copies of applications available on computers so members of the public can view them. However, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act classifies most information in the grant applications as not public until the state agency and grantee have negotiated a grant agreement. I just want your opinion on this, because this is something that I think the legislature would have to take care of. So are you familiar with this?
Ms. Gents.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, I am familiar with it. And we were happy that the auditors mentioned that, and we'll hope to work with this committee or the policy committees to have the law changed, the data practices law changed, so that we can be fully open and transparent. There is, pardon me, there's language in the open meeting law that says that any materials that are being discussed by the members need to be also available to the public. You know, you have materials here. So we have been erring on that side, even though there is a separate section of statutes that say you must, that proposals from a grant application cannot be considered public until after you've negotiated the grant contract. Oftentimes that has to do with trade secrets. There's little in proposals that is a trade secret, and those proposals become fully open to the public once we've negotiated the contract. So we will work with all of the appropriate members of the legislature to try to have that change made in the Data Practices Act.
Representative Green.
Thank you for that answer, and I don't envy you on that, because when it comes to data practice, you might have kind of a tough pull on your hands. The next one would be the conflicts of interest. Now, as board members, they have to file the papers for conflicts of interest. But as I understand it, you use an awful lot of volunteers to go through these projects, which is another issue we could talk about later too, and how they get trained as far as picking the projects that they think are right. But is there any plans by the Arts Board to require conflict of interest from your volunteers?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, we already do. all of the volunteers that we use need to sign a conflict of interest form. They declare their conflicts before they serve, and then they also sign a form. What the auditors were saying is that they want all Arts Board staff members to sign a conflict of interest form. So the person who reviews the application to see if all of the pieces that have to be there, they want that person to sign a conflict of interest form. They want our director of finance, who authorizes the payments, to sign a conflict of interest form. What we have been doing to this point is having anybody who is involved with the review of the applications, the program officers, the persons in the room working with the volunteers signing those conflict of interest forms, but we now will expand that, and so all of our staff will be signing conflict of interest forms. But the volunteers do, and so do our board members.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Green. Representative Green. Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the contracts. Apparently there's some things in the contracts that aren't quite clear, and the example they give is that the contracts did not identify changes to project budgets or activities that would require a contract amendment. In addition, guidance in the grant award letter about the grantees would begin spending funds was different than the potentially inconsistent with the contract language. Now that seems like it could be a real problem when it comes to finalizing these grant agreements. Have you guys have a way to address that?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Green, yes. So it's actually, I think it's two different issues in the document, and I'm sorry I don't have it in front of me. One is that when the grant contracts are sent out to the organization or the individual that has been selected, there's a cover letter on it that says, you need to sign the contract, pay particular attention to the reporting requirements and some other key elements in the contract. And then it says you can start your project after the contract is executed. That letter should actually say you can begin your project after the contract is executed or the starting date in the contract, whichever is later. And that's the language that's in the contract itself that they sign. So the legal document is clear that they cannot start the project until either the start date in the contract or the date that they and I sign it. It's the cover letter that isn't as clear as it needs to be, and so we will change that this year and make that clearer. I think your other point was about an applicant maybe not asking for a contract amendment or not being clear about when to ask for a contract amendment. What we've been doing with our individual artist grants, because artist projects generally start about 8 or 9 months after they've applied, so a lot of things can change, is that we have said in the award letters that any time a project changes, we'd like our grantees to call the program officer and talk about the changes so that she can help them problem solve or she can let them know if a contract amendment is necessary. What the auditors are recommending is that we set some basic requirements for this sort of change or that sort of change would absolutely trigger the need for a contract amendment, and so we will look at that and we will add some of that information into the contract to say that if you're going to make a certain kind of change, and we haven't decided what that change might be, then this would automatically trigger a contract amendment.
Okay.
Representative Green.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you kind of touched on this on the first one, but on the first part of your answer. But the Office of Grant Management requires that the plans be described of their intended uses before the funds are released. And is this what you were talking about? Because it says the board sent contracts to the councils we reviewed before receiving the council's final biennial plans.
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Green. I think that's actually two separate issues in the document. One is that the Regional Arts Councils, now Mr. Turner talked about the Regional Arts Councils create a biennial plan. They send us their preliminary plan, which we review very carefully. We have a committee that reviews the plan and discusses it and provides feedback. And then after they've gotten the feedback, after the legislature has finished the session and the appropriations amounts have been finalized, they send us a final copy of their plan and their final budget. What we've been doing is to send them their contract in advance of that so that they can sign it, and as soon as we get that final plan from them, we can be releasing the funds to them, because we want them to have funds to operate as early as July 1st so that they can be open and operating. And so the auditors have said that they don't think we should make we should not be sending the contract to them in advance of getting the final report. So that's something that we'll be working with the regional arts councils to resolve. The question about the Office of Grants Management is different because that doesn't impact the regional arts councils. They aren't necessarily required to follow the Office of Grants Management policies, but I think that what you might be referring to is that there are some things that that we should be disclosing in our grant guidelines, like the fact that they will have to do a final report, information about the makeup of the panel and the amount of money that will be awarded by that panel. We've not been putting that into the guidelines, but we will be adding that going forward.
Thank you, Ms. Jensa.
I've got more, but I'm not going to go into them because I'm looking at the clock.
Yep.
But I will say that, you know, it does kind of propose a little bit of a problem we can talk offline, because it seems to me like you're approving contracts before you get the final plans. You're sending out contracts before you get the final plans, so how do you review after you've already got the contract signed? But we can talk about that later.
Ms. Dents, will you be available to Representative Green to...
Looking forward to
it. Mr. Chair, yes, absolutely.
Okay,
I'll
good.
Set up a time to visit with him separately.
That's what I want to hear, and... we had some time, so it was actually worked out well that you could ask some questions. I'll make sure that everybody gets a copy of the audit report. I think it was generally pretty favorable, and you know, there's a lot of grants that are going out. So it's, but these are good questions as well. So thank you, Representative Green. Representative Hausman, I think you were on the list, and I think
yes,
Representative Murphy. You had a question later.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Hausman.
Just a couple of observations, if I could, about the discussion to the supplement and supplant issue earlier. I've often thought of this as it's the curse of being funded in several bills, because every chair feels demands and pressures as they're trying to make the budget work. And so it's so easy to say, oh, they get money in legacy, or they get money in environment finance, and because that takes some pressure off of the chair. And I think that's what sometimes happens, as we saw that declining number. And so it might be a blessing to think you're funded in several bills, but it can also be a curse. But to the other, the complexity of art, and while it is true that art sometimes calms, art also excites, art also offends, and as you pointed out, art also reflects many points of view, and I mean, in a sense that is the complexity we experience with art.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. Said Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Jens, Mr. Turner, I think we have enough time
yes.
to just explore. One of the points that you made at the beginning, Ms. Jens, was that the citizens are involved, and the regional art boards are involved, and the citizens are the regional art boards are composed of the citizens. So let's say that the announcements have been made that funding is available. You're looking for a variety of sources of individuals who may apply for a grant and meet all the principles and outcomes. And lots of people come and they sign up. And they say, I want a grant, I want a grant. And they fulfill the papers and they do everything that's right. And so the deadline comes, and here are all these wonderful projects that somebody thought was their very best. What's the process for whittling it down and selecting the grantees in your region?
Sure. Mr. Turner.
It's your people that are making the choices about your people and awarding the grants. Am I right?
Yeah.
Mr. Turner.
Yes, Representative Murphy. You are correct, yes. Yeah, just to step back, just one step backwards. It is all local folks. We represent five counties. We have two folks, residents from each of those counties with one at-large person. So those are all folks that are from the communities that are actually the requests are coming from as well. And be sure we have conflict of interest policies that we guide us through that as well. To get to your question, I believe, is yes, depending on the grant program, the criteria is there. It may differ from program to program depending on what the outcome of that program we want to do is. But at the topmost of it is the quality of the artistic expression or the quality of the art that's going to be produced is one of our top priorities. The next is the ability of that applicant to put on that activity to its fulfillment. So their capacity to do that and to do it well, because we know we're handling public dollars and we want to do that as well as we can. And then the third component is what is the need for that activity in their community. So has the applicant expressed, really have they done their due diligence and got addressing some kind of need that they're from their community. So if you want to get right down to the weeds, you know, we have a rubric which assigns points or a score to each one of those components, and they're weighted. I don't think we've only weighted down in that, but at the end of the day, those tallies are made. There's a score assigned to each application in that grant pool, and literally we just go down the line. The top rank gets funding until we don't have any money left in that category, and it does happen. There's actually more than not, there's great applications that do not get funded because we're funding at probably 75% or 80% of the good applications that we have. That answers your question.
Representative Murphy.
I
thank you. Good answer.
I've got a better understanding at this point. But how many people are involved in the point giving?
There's
Mr. Turner.
Thank you. For our actually board does the review, and that varies from council to council. There's some that use panels similar to the Minnesota State Arts Board. But for us, it would be 11 people making those decisions collectively.
And so the tallies would be among the greatest of the points that 11 people were decision makers.
Mr. Turner.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for coming. It is a big number. I think you said $66 million is going into this area. But how many organizations are there? There's 2,600 art or some art organizations. How many are there around the state of Minnesota that you're working with?
Mr. Chair, it's a bit of a fluid number because, is it only nonprofits? Is it organizations that are in the process of becoming nonprofits? We think it's about 1,600 arts organizations in the state of Minnesota. There are many, many more that are all volunteer that maybe don't have their own 501c3, but they have a fiscal agent. We require that, or the Regional Arts Council requires a fiscal agent to manage the funds. And there are somewhere, depending on whose number you use, somewhere between 40 and 50,000 individual artists, people who consider the arts to be a primary vocation in their lives. And you heard also today about a lot of social service organizations, health organizations, and others who see the value of the arts in their programming. So the number is just, it's mushrooming, and we're glad to see that it's mushrooming. It does mean that we all, the Regional Arts Councils and the Arts Board, say no to many, many more people than we say yes to. And we know that some of you hear from those people who we've had to say no to. But we really do take the process very seriously. And to respond to Representative Murphy's question, in our case, we use about 250 volunteers a year. And last year, they contributed about 12,000 volunteer hours to the process. So it is a big undertaking and would be expensive if it were all done by staff. But the diversity of input is really important to us.
Well, thank you very much for coming. You're by touching 104 million people. It looks like every year we're all being touched about 2.3 and quick math, by these dollars, by different arts projects, dollars being sent around the state. But it's really, I think, really helps the fabric of why people choose to live here and have all these big businesses that are here and good jobs. I was happy to see you haven't funded any authors from Litchfield, so that's that shows some good judgment. But
we would welcome an application from authors from Litchfield.
If you have an opportunity on the way out, again, thank you, the mayor from Red Wing, for coming down and or up rather, and then Miss Woods from just a really quick. I know we're going over for a second, but Miss Woods is wearing art, which I thought was pretty neat if you're willing and able. But these are Steger mucklucks from Ely, Minnesota. But the neat part she told me is that her grandmother or mother? Great-grandmother actually designed the pattern on the top.
Well, the leather pieces, the collar all put together.
So. You walk in front. We can't see.
Oh, you would like me.
So,
wait, I think I got it.
Wow, that's pretty good. That's a special reason to go to Duluth Days, I think. But and then she, please ask her afterwards. The same person came up with wicking sleeping bags as well, I think, or something. So, but again, thank you for the work that the arts folks are doing for Minnesota. And everybody, thank you for the questions today, Representative Green. Ms. Jentz, please visit with him. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you.